When we sang this morning, Columbia, the gem of the ocean, perhaps some of you had the same experience that I had, and that is that I cannot remember singing that since I was a boy in elementary school. And that's been a while back. It's probably not a great song, as songs go, but it has one phrase that I can remember made my blood run faster every time we sang it. The land of the free and the home of the brave. What I used to thrill about in the ignorance of boyhood, I have come to understand, believe in, and respect in manhood. For the belief that this is the home of the free and the land of the brave is surely an essential part of what we call the American dream. We take that emphasis out, and all we have left is a nightmare. It is easily the most distinctive, the most glorious part of our heritage. It indeed is worth singing about, thinking about, praying about. It is worth understanding. For our freedoms are our crown jewels, and we ought to cherish them as our most precious possession. And what a crown they make. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. None shines more brilliantly than freedom of religion. And we take it so easily for granted that we often fail to measure the full importance of its impact upon our lives. Without separating it for a moment from its companion freedoms, apart from which it cannot stand, we need to examine very carefully what we mean when we talk about religious freedom. The doctrine of religious freedom, breaking as it does with the ages-old doctrine of religious toleration, was truly revolutionary. It was so greeted when it began in colonial America, and it continues to be challenged today by a great portion of the world who still practice religious toleration. And since the contest on the one hand is between religious toleration and religious freedom on the other, we need to look at the claims of both as objectively as possible. The Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences is a great help to us at this point. Religious toleration implies three things. An established or a state church or a state religion. Second, the denial of complete equality to all who would dissent from a state church or a state religion. And third, revocable concessions to these other groups, the concessions of which are at the mercy of the dominant religious political system, and they have no guarantee of permanence. Now, this is the practice of religious toleration. Now, put against that is the principle of religious freedom. And religious freedom implies also about three different things. First, there is individual autonomy in the choice of a creed, a religious group, or a church. Complete individual autonomy. Second, there is autonomy of the church or religious group in all of its activities. And third, there is a legal equality to all of these religious groups. Before the law, they are all judged equally. Now, these are principles by which we have lived during the 200 years plus of our nation's history. And we have failed to realize how important they are. Simply to recite the differences between religious toleration on the one hand and religious freedom on the other hand is not enough. We must see that there is a great gulf between them. They do not shade into each other. They cancel each other out. And when we talk about religious freedom, we need to be very certain that that is exactly what we are expressing and what we are putting into practice. On May 15, 1955, in Colonial Williamsburg, which I'm sure many of you have visited, there was a celebration commemorating the American concept of religious freedom. Dr. Grayson Kirk, the president then of Columbia University, was the principal speaker. And Dr. Kirk said on that occasion, "One feature of the Virginia Declaration of Freedom had special significance. It was not content merely to proclaim religious toleration. It would have been compatible with the continued existence of an established church. True religious freedom," these Virginians held, "was more than tolerance. It was emancipation. It emancipated from all coercion. It fixed the neutrality of the state and proclaimed that the right to worship should be free to all, without civil penalties and disabilities." This was true religious freedom. This was revolutionary doctrine. Well, if we begin to probe into how our forefathers came to this principle, we may not be able to find all of the answers. Perhaps all we can say is only God knows. But a number of facts in colonial America seems to converge behind this notion. For one thing, the colonies were composed of a great number of people who have become greatly disturbed with some of the practices of the established churches of Europe. Some of these churches had terrorized them because they chose to dissent from certain views that were held by the church and its leadership. Leadership which was closely aligned with the political states. And so they fled Europe to find religious freedom. Some were Catholics, some were Protestant groups, some were Jewish. And the relationship in America was a relationship in which they tried to avoid a reestablishment of any church that would have this type of authority over the individual. There were also in the colonies a great emphasis upon the fact that we would have the proper religious leaders. And early in the colonial period, of America, there were some endeavors to have a church that was much like the established church of Europe. In fact, some of the colonies had their own prescribed churches. And as early as 1631, there was a law enacted in Massachusetts which said, "Ministers shall not give themselves to excess in drinking or riot, spending their time idly by day or night, playing at dice, cards, or any other unlawful game. But at all times convenient, they shall hear or read somewhat of the Holy Scriptures." Now, it sounds rather ironic that this type of a law had to be passed for ministers. You might call it a minimum morality for clergy. But it is one of the first times that it began to be obvious in the colonies that any type of law which demanded certain things of religious leadership or of religious groups began to move into the realm of religious toleration rather than religious freedom. And it was the beginning of the concept of religious freedom in America. Of course, another powerful impulse in the direction of religious freedom was the fact that there were businessmen in the New World who wanted to trade with the Old World. There were Protestant colonies in America that wanted to trade with Catholic nations like Spain and France and Italy. And so there had to be complete religious freedom in order that they would not be cut off from the opportunity to trade. And still another source of the strength in our early colonies came from the perhaps not too welcome hands of those who were proclaimed deists. These were individuals who believed in God, had a very strong faith, but had a profound mistrust of the church, the clergy, and of traditional theology. They felt that their lives centered in God and no one should tell them how to express it. And some of the leading exponents of our colonial government were deists. And they probably exerted an influence far beyond their meager numbers. And understandably, they were opposed to the idea of toleration, and instead, they voiced themselves strongly for the principle of complete individual freedom. While Jefferson lacked a lot of being a thoroughgoing deist, he had been influenced by the deistic movement in America, and his passionate demand for full freedom of thought and individual expression of worship may have come from his influence, his association with those who were deists. Well, having said those ideas, I would like to move on quickly to quote James Madison. One of our early leaders had this to say: the religion of every man must be left to the conviction and conscience of every man. It is the right of every man to exercise these in the manner of his choosing. It's an inalienable right. We maintain, therefore, that in matters of religion, no man's right is abridged by the institution of society, and that religion is completely exempt from its cognizance. Thomas Jefferson, as he returned from the Constitutional Congress to Virginia, first to care for his ill wife, and later to become very involved in the establishment of the Virginia Commonwealth, was bitterly opposed to any effort to establish a church. And his was the guiding hand that wrote the Statute of Religious Freedom for Virginians in 1786, 10 years after the Declaration of Independence. And Jefferson later, in one of his writings, commented that on his headstone, when he was buried, there were three things that he wanted to be remembered for: that he was a part of the Constitutional Congress, that he had drafted the Declaration of Independence, that he had been the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And this is how it reads: being enacted by the General Assembly, that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burdened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or beliefs, but that all men shall be free to profess, and by argument to maintain, their opinion in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capabilities. Now, we read that in the light of our practice today, and we say, well, that really isn't saying much. But 200 years ago, that was revolutionary doctrine. And the genius of the freedom of worship that we have enjoyed in this nation is based upon that principle. I would pray that God will have mercy on us if we take it for granted and if we fail to cultivate it and feed it and allow it to flourish in the future. Like all freedoms, it is always in need of reinterpretation, of re-emphasis, of vigorous defense in every generation. Those who believe in religious toleration throughout the world still look at the American way and often scoff at it. In fact, about 15 years ago, when the World Council of Churches was meeting, one of the dramatic sessions of that meeting evolved around the fact that the churches of America were speaking forth about the idea and the concept of religious freedom, and the churches of Europe were trying to defend the principle of religious toleration. The account has not been settled yet, but we need to beware lest in America we slip into the principle of religious toleration. The Roman Catholic Church in America, as well as in the world, still has not accepted the notion of religious freedom. The Church still avidly preaches and teaches the concept of religious toleration. The acceptance of other religious groups, not the denial of other religious groups, but the acceptance only in the basis that they will be tolerated until the true church, the one holy Catholic Church, comes into being. But the Roman Catholic Church is not alone in this. There are those in the American Protestant scene who also are in the danger of misunderstanding religious freedom as opposed to religious toleration. The whole issue of prayer in the public schools is decidedly an issue of religious toleration versus religious freedom. Prayer has never been abolished in the public schools of America. Formal written prayers have been abolished. The difference is very important, and it needs to be understood by every thinking Christian. Written prayers cause those who do not follow profession of the manner in which the prayer is written to be a part of an experience of worship or of faith that may be alien to their own religious persuasion and thus a denial of their religious freedom. We may not like what others believe and practice. But when the majority voice in America begins to put into the classroom or anywhere else a prescribed type of prayer to which all must give allegiance and faith, then we are on the verge of making our practice religious toleration rather than religious. Understand me carefully. I believe that there ought to be the opportunity for prayer in schools, but it ought to be the opportunity for individual expression, for it is the only way in which the concept of freedom of religion can be carried forth to generations yet to come. It also has something to do with the sending of an ambassador to the Vatican. But this, of course, opens up an entirely different issue with regard to the decision of the state to recognize a particular religious system. all of these issues are issues of religious freedom as opposed to religious toleration. And when we begin to talk about freedom, it means the right to believe as reason and conscience dictate, the right to worship God accordingly, the right to live and act out according to your belief, to state your belief freely in all forms of expression, art, journalism, radio, television, other media, the responsibility to seek for others the same freedom in the field of religion. Quite frankly, I am very disturbed by many of the religious television programs that I see, because the theology that is behind many of these programs is not the theology that I believe as a follower of Christ. But I will protect to my death the right of these television preachers to have the opportunity for their expression. An interesting thing has happened in just the last 2 years in the American scene. The followers of Sun Myung Moon, the group that many refer to as the Moonies, have a case pending in the federal courts. The case involves some restrictions that they deem to be a part of a denial of their religious freedom. The greatly misunderstood National Council of Churches, which probably is as far from the position of the Moonies as any organization could be, has joined with the American Civil Liberties Union and others in the defense of the Moonies. Not because the Moonies are practicing what we would like to see practiced. Not because the established churches of America want to help this particular sect, but because the basic principle of religious freedom is once again being tested. We need to beware, because to us as religious groups, whether large or small, religious freedom means the right to join and work in any religious group, the right to educate our children in that faith, the right to seek the conversion of others, the right to withdraw from a religious fellowship and join another if we please, or perhaps to withdraw and join none at all, and the responsibility to strive for a society in which these rights will be protected for all persons and all religious groups. I recognize that this is heavy, difficult, and demanding. But unless we allow religious freedom for every person, and religious freedom for every religious group, then we stand in danger of losing religious freedom for us all. It takes bravery to stand for freedom. It always has. Let us beware that we do not confuse religious freedom with religious toleration. May we pray for you. Eternal God, you have blessed us with a free land. You have given us many privileges. Help us, O God, that we may live with the privilege to serve you well and faithfully. We do ask that you will guide us and help us, that we may constantly live as those who have been born free. Christ.